Are they trying to start a race war? They want us to have a race war? Is that where this is going?
Pretty much.
Why do they want that? This is new. I haven't heard about a race war. But I think they're trying to start one. I remember like having this conversation with myself.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is January 11th. Happy New Year. I am sorry that it has taken me so long to wish you one. I have returned from my extensive travels. I arrived back in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania earlier this week. What a time visiting Connecticut, New York, New Hampshire, and Maryland. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in just a minute. But I do understand that it has been a while since you've heard from me, and there are a lot of new shows coming this month. Zach Slabeck actually just left the Studio of Champions. We did a long-form conversation about how ambitious young people can find mentors, teachers, and coaches, and how to determine when and why you need one. That's a big show, and I didn't want to release it on a Friday. Friday is not the optimal day for podcast releases, so that will be coming Monday. Every once in a while, I do what is called free AV, where I take a selection from our expansive bonus content section, the AV Club, and I throw it on the podcast feed for everyone to hear. Recently, I have been working on excavating and sorting old School Sucks content all the way back to 2009. For a project that I'm working on this year for YouTube. Part of this project is going back and sorting all the old shows. And I stumbled across this audio from 2016. I was dismayed to learn that only 48 people have ever gotten to hear this. It's a great conversation. And I said, gosh, I wish there was a reason to put this out for everybody. I say that about so many things. There are hundreds of shows like this in our bonus content section. And this one is particularly apropos right now. But before I get into that, let me tell you this. In my travels, I stopped in New York to see a friend, and he had this kind of ideas summit for a weekend at his house where a group of people came together. And we discussed and debated politics and religion and philosophy while eating pork, slow-cooked pork, all weekend long. When I left, I was driving through beautiful upstate New York, and I said, God, I don't have enough of that in my life. In fact, the closest experience that I had to this amazing and energizing weekend, this past weekend, was something that I participated in. I think it was my idea. I'm going to give myself credit for the idea. In 2015 and again in 2016 at the Porcupine Freedom Festival, I went for many years in a row. And in 2015, I was doing a radio show called The Freedom Fiends with past School Sucks participants, Davi Barker, MK Lords, and Derek J. Freeman. And after the show ended, I said, guys, let's just do more show. And then it became this kind of challenge where we were holding each other accountable to record until the dawn. It became known as the Dawn of Freedom. It was a magical event, if you ask me, but people do say that I overuse the word magical, so maybe ask somebody else who listened what their opinion is too. We recreated this event in 2016 with some of the same people. Davi was there, Derek was there. We also added my friend Daryl Becker, who had come to New Hampshire from Hawaii, Nick Hazelton, who was making his first appearance at the Porcupine Freedom Festival, and Lou Fien, who is one of the hosts of the Freedom Fiends. So a whole group of us participate in this powwow. We go even longer than the previous year. We cover even more subjects. We have debates. We have laughs. We entertain ourselves and a small group of insomniacs who stayed up to watch us again until and beyond the dawn. I only ever released one part of it. because the conversation was so meandering, and it happened at a time when I was certainly prioritizing more structure in the podcast. But I came across it and I said, damn, only 48 people have ever gotten to hear this. I wish I had a reason to change that. And I think I found one. And it relates to current events. If you had told me 10 years ago that one day the media would relentlessly attack the executive branch of government, the mainstream media, and almost all the entertainment media would engage in a vigorous campaign to destroy the credibility and hamstring the agenda of the President of the United States, I would have expected it to be way cooler. I would have expected to like it. I would have expected it to at least be watchable. But as we all know, that is not the case. In fact, it's so bad that I have watched a lot of past philosophical and political brethren pushed into the arms of this Donald Trump. It has even affected me. I find myself agreeing with people like Tucker Carlson and Ben Shapiro a little bit more frequently than what I'm comfortable with. It's been, I mean, when you look at like geopolitics and real threats to our lives, like, you know, 9/11-y type stuff, it's been kind of an uneventful couple of years for this presidency. But the Democratic politicians and the mainstream media and the late night comedy dipsticks have cried so much wolf that now, like in this past week, as things actually take a serious and I think potentially dangerous turn, no one is listening. The very act of them trying to sound the alarm about something tells a lot of us that there's actually nothing to worry about. I mean, it's almost like Trump called Seth Meyers and Jim Acosta and Anna Navarro and Joe Scarborough and 100 people that I'm not naming to that boardroom from The Apprentice and was like, look, okay, so when I get elected, you just go out there and be like, Trump is bad because of this and Trump is bad because of that. But always do it while looking and acting like the world's biggest dickheads. And we will just sail right through the first 4 years. I mean, that's like what's happening. The whole thing has become such a comedy that potentially serious threats are just reduced to punchlines and memes. The other day, I'm catching up on the news and I see this exchange.
Have you considered using emergency powers to grant yourself authorities to build this wall without congressional approval? And second,
yes,
on Mexico, you have.
Yes, I have. And I can do it if I want.
So you don't need congressional approval to build the wall?
No, we can use them. Absolutely. We can call a national emergency because of the security of our country. Absolutely. No, we can do it. I haven't done it. I may do it. I may do it.
But even if a group of engineers could go to Donald Trump and prove the opposite, that the wall wouldn't do any of the things that he claims it can do as far as slowing the flow. Sorry to use, you know, this language, but slowing the flow of illegal immigrations or drug cartels or coyotes, or it won't do any of that. They prove it. There's beyond a reasonable doubt. His most trusted advisors say the engineers are right, Don. This doesn't work. It doesn't mean he would want it any less, right? The wall is just a symbol. If somebody had played those words to me coming from the mouth of the President of the United States 10 years ago, good heavens, I would have been very upset. But if I'm being really truthful here, the first thing I thought of after seeing that, after hearing that, was I bet MSNBC and CNN are going to be hilarious right now. And that's being a pretty bad guardian of freedom. For the last 18 years, most Americans have passively watched the state create all of the infrastructure, run the wires, lay the pipes for the police state, leaving some person in the future, and maybe that future is now, with nothing left to do but flip the switch and turn it on. Happening, I would say, at a time of unprecedented division and mass distraction. And shifting agendas. I mean, let's remember that the person who has been most vocal over the course of the last 20 years with the largest platform warning people about the emerging police state post 9/11 has been Alex Jones, who seems to spend most of his broadcast now jacking off to the idea of a unilateral executive if it's Donald Trump. And here we have this autocratic president who I believe is more deranged than many of the presidents that I've endured in my lifetime, talking about declaring a state of emergency and broad executive powers, to borrow FDR's language, to build a wall. And I feel like a lot of the people I'm friends with on Facebook are just kind of laughing about the whole thing. Either, you know, Trump as kind of this, it's almost like he's a fictional character, or the sort of dehumanizing, I hate to use that word, but this sort of dehumanizing treatment of the people who are hysterical about Trump. That is most of what I'm seeing. You might be saying, Brett, you need new, more constructive Facebook friends. I find myself in conflict about this very thing. I see these like libertarian generated memes about how walls don't work. Yeah, they work. Sorry, walls are great for keeping people out, for keeping people in. They're like a dual purpose in that way, and they have a really successful track record throughout history. They work for Israel. They worked in various places in Eastern Europe. China, I understand, had pretty good success with the wall for a while. Hadrian's Wall was especially dope. Oh, my God. If you're into walls, take your pants down and search YouTube for Hadrian's Wall, and you're going to have an incredible night. Hadrian's Wall was built like 1,900 years ago, obviously by hand. It spanned the entire landmass of Roman Britain from coast to coast, admittedly in a skinny part of Britain, east to west. It is 15 feet high. And then there's like a 10-foot trench on the approach to the wall. So if the Scottish tribes that the wall was built to keep out, the Scots weren't sending their best. But if the Scottish tribes stormed the wall, they would have to go down into this trench and then climb like 30 or 40 feet just up to the base of the wall to get filled with arrows by Roman soldiers. And if they crossed the wall, Romans would have ample opportunity to pick them off as they had to work their way through this up and down another series of trenches south to the wall. As far as walls go, Hadrian's Wall is one to get excited about. And many of you who are unfamiliar might be curious, did Hadrian's Wall work? Did it effectively contain the barbarians in the north? I guess it could have worked if there were way more Roman soldiers to stand atop the wall and guard it. But unfortunately, there were huge, like vast open spaces of the wall. And even though there were several conflicts at the wall, there were also numerous opportunities for people in the north to go climb the wall, escape over the other side, and disappear to the south, probably undetected. But other Roman historians have argued that the wall had nothing to do with protection or containment. The wall was just a physical demonstration of imperial power. Or even, and you're going to find this difficult to believe, a lasting monument to the egotistical emperor himself. So depending on what you accept for motives for Hadrian's Wall, you could certainly argue that in a couple of cases, it worked. Definitely demonstrated Roman imperial power, and we're still talking about this Hadrian almost two millennia later. Others might argue, Brett, perhaps you haven't seen the latest Game of Thrones. That's a fine point, but I do think the wall worked for thousands of years. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if you're just getting into Game of Thrones. Some things are going to happen at the wall. There's going to be some structural integrity issues. I will not say anymore. I'm so sorry. I will not say anymore. None of this even matters, though. If you're a libertarian and you're having the pragmatic argument about the wall, you've kind of already lost. You know, you've kind of already ceded the important part of the discussion, and you close yourself into a very narrow conversation. Here's where I'm at. It will be built or it won't. There's no principle argument that I can put together that makes any kind of a difference in this situation. That's frustrating. There isn't any way that you can sit somebody down who supports the wall and examine the roots of the problems that the wall is purported to prevent. The walls that I'm more concerned with are virtual. They're the walls of the echo chambers that just grow higher and higher and higher, seeming like event after event. The echo chamber walls, they grow. And as I've been observing the news over the last couple weeks, aware of this deeper social problem and how it affects the policy discussion that we've watched on wherever you watch or talk about the news. And I remembered this conversation from 2016 when we were at the beginning of this and we were a group of liberty-minded people, not all uniform in belief, right? Everybody brought unique perspectives to this conversation, but we were trying to figure out what Donald Trump meant and how Donald Trump fit into a lot of the things that we were seeing as far as an emerging culture war that I didn't even start paying attention to until probably 2015. So this seems like not that long ago, 2.5 years ago, but it was a very, very different world. And I thought those of you who are fans of these sort of free-form discussions might enjoy this flashback to the dawn of this new era that we are in. This was before the election. This was before Charlottesville. There is far less of a chilling effect on our speech. That being said, I will offer up a trigger warning. This show contains very strong and offensive language. I hope you find it interesting and valuable. And if you want more discussions like this, please let me know. We don't have to wait until the summer, in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere. I could be doing stuff like this in Pittsburgh at this very table. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we will be back in just a couple days with brand new content for 2019. Take care.
Video now circulating on social media showing a racially offensive song being played over the loudspeaker at a homecoming football game in Henrico. This happened at Glen Allen when the varsity team took on the visiting team from John Marshall in Richmond. School administrators are now apologizing. Henrico reporter Ashley Monford live outside that school. Ashley, what went on here?
Well, there's a lot of outrage over this song. Now, Henrico administrators tell me a Glen Allen student was in charge of that song playlist, and they believe that student inserted the offensive song the day of the homecoming. Glen Allen and John Marshall's varsity football teams were warming up for homecoming when this song came on. Lucas Harris, a former John Marshall football player, started recording.
At first, I was wondering if I heard that right. Yeah, we were all very surprised, all very shocked, offended.
The racially offensive song is a parody of the cartoon DuckTales theme song. We found it aired on a comedy talk radio show and was posted to YouTube.
They're and they're so I hate them!
Hare says John Marshall coaches reacted quickly to calm players. The school is predominantly African American.
Really, that just ignited us, gave us motivation to go out there and win. And we played our best game of the year. We really came together as a family. Everybody played their best game of the year.
Henrico school administrators also reacted quickly. This letter of apology was sent from the Glen Allen principal to the John Marshall principal. She says she's appalled and says, quote, "This unfortunate incident does not reflect the broader Glen Allen community."
It's inappropriate. It's actually vulgar and obscene.
Henrico school board chair John Montgomery had this to say.
There was a young person involved, and it'll be a learning moment for them as well. And if we need to make some adjustments, which we probably will to our process, and those will be made promptly so it won't happen again.
And more apologies may be due in the future.
The person who did it, do you think that they need to apologize to the coaches, to the John Marshall football team in person?
I would appreciate that. The John Marshall staff, coaches, players, they would all appreciate that very much.
The disciplinary action is being taken against the student responsible. Montgomery says that the school board is suggesting that that student also apologize in person to the John Marshall community. Henrico school board officials also reached out to Richmond school board officials apologizing for the incident as well.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Dawn of Freedom, part three. We begin at 2:46 a.m., and this is going to carry us past the 4 o'clock mark, where it starts to get light out and things heat up. In this segment of the show, we're going to venture into some new topics, including the alt-right, the ignition of a race war in the United States, and gosh, I hate to do identity politics. I hate to exploit this stuff, but I was coming into this show
very much aware in the media, especially the media leading towards the right, there has been a campaign to pit Muslims and gays against each other. And this has been spearheaded by people like Gavin McGinnis and Milo Yiannopoulos, who actually went down to Orlando the week after the nightclub shooting and basically joined together. They made out for a while, too, as a kind of publicity stunt. But they joined together to encourage gays to arm up against Muslims. And like I said, I don't like to be exploitatious here, but Derek J. Freeman sat down with us in this portion of the show, and he is gay. He's the host of Flaming Freedom, and I wanted to get his thoughts on Milo and that whole controversy. And Davi, who's been with us since the beginning, is a Muslim. So I was really interested in hearing perspectives that you don't usually get to hear in that conversation, which is largely being run, that conversation, through outlets like Breitbart.com. So I almost made this a podcast. I think this is a little bit too hot for the podcast. So it is here instead, like segments 1 and 2. I would be interested to hear your thoughts on these topics. So you can post a comment on the show page at schoolsucksproject.com, or you can drop your thoughts in the School Sucks group, if you're a member, right under the post for this installment of The Dawn of Freedom. So lots more to come. We're still approaching the halfway point here. I'm glad to see that people are downloading and listening. And like I said, share your thoughts with other listeners. All right, here we go. As we pick this up, we're talking about Bernard von Notthaus, who is the creator of a private currency called the Liberty Dollar. And this was a big deal, I think, about 5 years ago when he was tried and convicted of counterfeiting, allegedly for the purpose of domestic terrorism. But he is not in jail. He is minting Trump coins right now, which is what we're going to be discussing when this portion of the audio starts. And he was at Porkfest last year and this year. So just a little bit of context. Let's roll it.
Bernard von Notthaus tried to steal $10 from me. I'm almost convinced of it, but it was sleight of hand and circusry. So,
is this for his Trump coin?
Yeah.
He made a Trump coin?
Damn. He made a Donald Trump coin. He handed it to me and said, I don't want this face in my house. Like, I bought one of the porcupine ones. He marks them with the year.
Cool. I was so confused that Bernard would make a Trump coin, but it seemed like he was doing it kind of tongue in cheek. Like,
it seemed that way. But it seems like his tongue is always in his cheek, so I just don't know.
How sweet is the coin? What's Trump doing?
It's actually really sweet. It says Trump the president or something, and so it's sort of like a double entendre of like, hey, maybe we don't need a president. And then there's also special edition ones that have New Hampshire outline on the back, which, like, you know, I'm not crazy about the outline of New Hampshire. It's not a particular sexy figure or anything, but
no,
the idea of independence is kind of cool, you know?
Is no Trump face?
Yeah, Trump's face is on it, unfortunately. Yeah,
I like that.
You'd like it? I guess it adds value to anything he puts his face on.
I really like, the only way that that would be a valuable thing to me is if it was in a series of other villains. Mm-hmm. Like that's what, if I could get like a 12-piece set with like Trump and
Lex the Penguin.
Lex Luthor would be good.
That would be great.
That would be cool. He's more of a comic book villain, though. He's like Kingpin or
the Penguin.
Well, they have to
Penguin, good example.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm interested now that you're here, and this could be a hot topic. Mm. Do we see Trump as like an equal and opposite response to what's been happening on the college campuses in America? I mean, yeah. I'm interested in your point of view because...
I love it. It's so much fun. I mean, yeah, it is an equal and opposite like pushback of... Everyone's getting crazier. It's just like we can't... I don't know if there's... No ability to reach across the aisle and exchange ideas anymore, or like the internet is giving people an opportunity to go down rabbit holes and never encounter any other alternative ideas or something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But like somehow it's just everyone is getting more and more fixated on their own thing, myself included, and like having no time for everything else. And I think Trump does a good job of like bringing everyone together with his own narrative. And he's like, I'm going to push forward with this is what's important. And I'll tell you, I'm building a wall and it's getting bigger. And like, you know, people can rally behind that narrative. It's fun. It's ballsy. And it's unapologetic, which I think is what we want. Like, I'm craving, you know, unapologetic people. Enough of this social justice warrior. My feelings are hurt. Like
safe space.
Yeah, I know safe spaces. He's great for that. Well, that scratches that itch.
The thing is, that's the interesting thing, because I do find that there is this appeal in it, and I never thought I would say that, because
it's all a fight over the commons. Those people can totally have a society where those words are used. Those people can totally have a society where those words aren't used.
Yeah.
The only thing anybody's fighting about is what happens in the common areas.
Right.
Well, I'm thinking like broader picture here of a lot of us worked really hard to kind of broaden the libertarian conversation to, you know, being able to connect with people, Daryl included in this process. There's a lot of people, from what I see, who do not want to connect. They don't want that connection. It's not like, oh, we're just not building the right bridge to these people. They thrive on this animosity and vitriol and division, and they're trying to expand it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that Trump is a kind of answer to that, almost.
I want to address what Derek said. He's a response and a reaction to all the social justice warrior stuff.
His popularity is. He's not directly responsive. I don't even know if he knows what that means. But his acceptance and people's embrace of him is definitely a response to that.
Okay. But he's not providing a solution to it. So it's just like, all right, you're going to be assholes? Well, we're going to find an even bigger asshole. And that's essentially the role that Trump is playing in this case here. People are fired up about the social justice warrior nonsense. So rather than coming to their senses, they go to the opposite extreme. It's like the whole brutalist and humanitarian debate that was going on just a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like we're seeing like magnets like in... What's that? Opposite directions?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I see happening.
Perception management.
Talk about that?
Yeah, sure. This is what's going on. You know, you got the divide and conquer. Got the people who want the Elmo, people who want the Cookie Monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really pretty simple.
If some people
want to
feel the urn.
Feel that urn.
What about Oscar the Grouch? That's all I'm saying.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Is there a real metaphor here? Is like Elmo Democrat and Cookie Monster Republican, or what's the allegory here?
Elmo make fun, and then you know,
it's like no need cookie.
You know, it's really very simple.
You know? Oscar the Grouch is the Republican.
I think he's really like Bernie Sanders is Oscar the Grouch.
Oh yeah,
you know
he looks like
the green guy.
Can.
Yeah,
yeah, he's kind of like the hair.
They have that in common.
Green. Yeah. Oh, he's got like Nutty Professor hair.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's like just you kids, and then slams the can, you know, on top of himself. But yeah, it's really a perception management. This is like what people are like. Oh, finally, there's that guy. Or I haven't met any Hillary supporter. That woman, mm-hmm. like. That person I can support finally. Like
you haven't met any Hillary supporters?
I haven't met a Hillary supporter. So I'm like, to me, they're still mythical.
I got a grandmother that's a Hillary supporter because they like the same sports team.
It's like that simple sometimes. It's like, you see?
So
it's
or at least she said she was a fan of whatever the local sports team was at the time.
So to what level do people want to own their minds? You know, to like actually like unhinge that kind of thing? So the older folks, yeah, it's kind of... They're a little out there. They're not really ready to open that one up.
I'm surprised you haven't met any. They're out there. I mean, like, it's about a woman thing, and it's about a competence thing, which I don't understand at all, but, like...
You've met some?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. At the Cheshire County Fair, I was hawking Bitcoin, and there were Hillary supporters who came and set up with their little booth and were like, you registered? Or you know, come register Democrat. We're going to get Hillary.
So, I feel like we're reporting back on movements from hostile territories.
Yeah, it was weird. I don't know. I don't care about that. The best thing, the people who are engaged in politics obviously have no clue what's going on, you know? So but the people who are really entertaining this election cycle are the YouTube video people who are grabbing and mixing the election, like bad lip readings or the one of Hillary cackling where she's saying like she wants to destroy Iran. These are the people who make the election exciting for me. They grab the C-SPAN videos or the debates, and then they remix them to make them entertaining. Have you seen this?
Yeah. I think this is a good season for people who want to kind of ride that wave. What do you think of Milo?
Yeah, I mean he's really fun. I guess everyone knows who Milo is, right? Mm-hmm. They're just troublemaker.
Yannopoulos.
I love that he. makes he gets a reaction. He makes people upset, but I don't find him likable. Also, I was bummed. You know, nobody's perfect. Like, I had, I guess, a hero complex thing going with him because he's handsome and he has a lot of the right ideas. He's articulate and gets in the face of social justice warriors. Can't knock that. But then he went on the Joe Rogan podcast and was talking about how he thinks that circumcision is good, and that his reasoning is that, well, you don't have to put those in your mouth and I do. And, you know, so his preference, like his aesthetic preference for guys who have been genitally mutilated, it trumps every, you know, trumps your opinion. Or
genetically modified?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And for some, it's a choice, not for most.
Sure, yeah, it could be. But I was offended by that. I was annoyed that he wouldn't, like, when Joe Rogan tried to get him to at least face reality and acknowledge that babies don't have any choice in that, and maybe it would be the right thing to do to give them a choice regarding their own body, and he wasn't having any of that.
How young
thinking,
can they make the choice?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's this collection of people emerging like in the last few years, or at least in, you know, in my world, they're emerging. Yeah. People like McGinnis and people like Milo. Yeah. And they're holding like such attractive and such disgusting beliefs at the same time. Mm. So Milo also said like gay people should go back in the closet because they have higher IQs, so they should marry, like gay men should marry women and have children, and then just when their family goes to bed, go out and fuck guys.
They should breed for IQ?
Like, what an upbringing he must have had. I don't know. I feel bad for him.
It wasn't
like, get
good.
Into therapy or something, man. Like,
yeah, it wasn't good.
Yeah.
I think him and Rogan got into that a little bit on the show.
They did.
Yeah. So you heard it too.
I did, and I felt the same thing as Derek. I was very disappointed by his clear lack of critical thinking. I mean, the guy is brilliant, right? The guy has some very—he's very smart, but he's missing
huge blind spots.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's all the method. Like, how do you come upon your conclusions? You know, like those are conclusions. The dude came up with those conclusions, and there's a way he did that. You know, and like.
I don't know who these people are at all. Is this scientific justification for circumcision? Is that who we're talking
no,
about?
No, it's not scientific. It's aesthetic.
Scientific?
No, purely aesthetic.
They're making an impassioned argument for an aesthetic preference?
Yes.
On the basis of an aesthetic preference.
That's correct.
Too small of a sample size.
Yeah, well, that's you know? That's what was so deplorable about it, I think, to Joe Rogan. So, I mean, Milo's a provocateur, and you don't know who he is?
No, I haven't followed this.
Hasty generalization.
I was raised with this as clear as day. So, like, I was not circumcised for this very reason. This issue is old to me.
Yeah.
Like,
that's not Milo's issue.
So I don't follow it. I know my position. It's obvious. I don't need to follow the controversy.
Okay, so, but that was just a kind of an aside to Milo's whole thing. Milo Yiannopoulos is a Greek name, but he's British. He is, I think he's the editor-at-large for Breitbart, which is a conservative news site. He is a very, very vocal Trump supporter. He's also gay. He calls Donald Trump daddy.
Yeah,
I
like.
Okay, but recently he went around the country, college after college, doing what he called the Dangerous Faggot Tour.
Awesome.
Where he would basically confront the social justice left on how they're destroying free speech on campuses. And I think it was in every place he go, they would shout him down. They would off the stage. They would basically ruin the events.
They played right into his hand. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he wants them to do. And then there's all these videos of these people behaving badly. And then he gets to be put in a more rational light. Like, look how calm I am. And look, you know, obviously he doesn't even have to make an argument. Because it's all in the form.
Oh, like saying, here's my opponents.
Right.
And
yeah, exactly.
So the other, you know, the other end, side of that coin is me. So right. I'm right. Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very clever strategy, and he's had some really good things to say, and he's definitely a sharp guy, and I appreciate the fight for free speech in academia, because that's a really bold fight, and it's a losing fight, it seems like, lately, because even though those social justice people are a tiny minority, they are so loud that they are actually shaping college policies on things like diversity and academic equality and the destruction of free speech. You know, and obviously there's no such thing as academic equality. And when it comes to diversity, yes, thank you for coming. You're black. Oh, you're Chinese. Oh, you're gay. Oh, you're transgender. Hooray.
As long as you're all socialist.
As long as there's no diversity in thought.
Right.
Right? Because then there is no tolerance. Like, where's the bathroom for
this? This is why I can't stand California. That's the culture now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like Berkeley spreads way beyond the campus walls, man.
Start
like,
going places and saying, where's the pro-gun bathroom?
Yeah, right? Where's the open carry bathroom?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Milo is great, I think.
So who's Milo?
Milo Yiannopoulos, but huge, great presentation style. Like, very, very polished guy.
Yeah.
And Derek's right, good-looking guy, beautiful British accent. The other one is Gavin McGinnis, who was one of the founders of Vice, and he's really emerged in the last year or so, too. Both of them, ironically, I heard of for the first time on Joe Rogan. Mm. Both times, I said, this guy is a troll. And they both kind of are, but they have some intellectual cred, too. So McGinnis was one of the founders of Vice, and then he kind of started turning up the volume on the Stefan Molyneux, West is the best, Freedom Club, like that kind of rhetoric, Western chauvinism type stuff, and has some really, really prescriptive views about family and marriage and what kind of woman are you if you're 35 years old and you're not married and you don't have children.
My favorite thing he did was tell a woman on live national TV that she would have been happier as a mother staying at home, that she's like making a bad choice for her life right now to go be on a talk show, that she should go home and be with kids.
Is that Gavin McGinnis?
Yeah.
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 But
I thought that was brave and possibly correct. But I only say that's correct, but judging by her reaction to it.
She didn't seem happy at all. Right.
I think he might have been right, which was bold to go out
because
and just say that to
what
her.
Makes you think he was right? What was it about her reaction?
She was unhappy and like considering it. Like, I think she was like, I have to reject this out of hand because you're just being offensive and chauvinistic. But then was like, actually, maybe you're right. Like, she didn't say that out loud, but you could kind of see it in her eyes, you know? I don't know. Was I reading into it?
Yeah, but she didn't seem happy to begin with.
Right.
So even if he was just like, hey, whatever you're doing, maybe you should try something else.
Yeah.
Because this doesn't seem to be working for you. Nick, how are you enjoying the snacks?
I am enjoying them very much.
Good, because I saw you had an apple. You're having some pepitas.
I'm hungry, yeah.
All right, good. I'm glad. I'm glad I brought this
pepitas?
Stuff. Pepitas? That's the Spanish word for pumpkin seeds.
Oh, cute. Toasted?
No, they're raw. I actually like them raw and unsalted. They don't taste the best that way, but that's how they're the best for you.
And they're holeless, which is interesting. I usually see them with holes. But
and what?
My father.
Why would they have holes in them?
Holes.
Hull. H-U-L-L. Oh,
like a shell.
A hole. Oh.
Oh, yeah. I get them raw and hulled.
And they're anti-parasite.
Mm-hmm. You will, if you leave them around a while, they'll get some little wormies in there, though.
I mean, they're magic.
I mean, yeah. They're magic. Yeah.
They're magic beans.
Why not?
But either one of those guys could be like the press secretary for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And they could be. And so their popularity over the last year, like we say, Trump is an equal and opposite response to the social justice left, but it is that acceptance and the vocalization of that acceptance of somebody who is so fucking ridiculous in so many ways when it comes to the presidency, that those are really, really interesting guys to watch. And I find myself very intrigued by what both of them are doing. They went down to this Orlando shooting. And, you know, they like Milo gave a very openly anti-Islam, gays should arm up basically for the sake of Western civilization kind of. I mean, that was. Did you see that, Derek?
No, I didn't see that. That's great, though.
Say that again?
In Saudi Arabia, maybe they should.
But see, that's.
Muslims aren't coming for gays in America. Muslims are already oppressing gays in other countries. And in those countries, maybe they should.
Yeah.
Like, man, I wish I remembered this better. Angela Keaton has a whole talk on it. Do you know the famous gay riots, police versus
Stonewall
riots? Thank you. Like, it is a part of resisting oppression,
fighting back.
Yeah.
Yeah, not anymore. Stonewall is all like anti-Second Amendment, and yeah, they have a big Obama
I just
poster
mean,
out in front of
philosophically,
them.
Philosophically, like, there are underground homosexual meetups in Saudi Arabia. This happens. There's also an undercurrent of heterosexual men having sex because they can't meet a woman.
That's everywhere.
Yeah, but this is because, like, logistically speaking, the society does not allow you to meet one.
Oh.
Like, it's not like you can't find a consenting partner. It's like you can't find a consenting partner, right? Like, anyway, this is something that happens. If one of those camps or one of those, I don't even know what to call them, underground clubs was raided by the Department of Enjoining Good and Forbidding Evil, yeah, I hope they're armed.
Yeah. Yeah. But the us versus them spin that's being put on this stuff, because the idea they're perpetuating is that what is going on in some of these Middle Eastern countries is coming here. You know, it's coming. That's what they're saying.
That was a really poignant part of Will's whole campaign. That since it is not the religion, it is something that another religious group can do, and it's the same mentality, and that that people in power in the United States have the same mentality as people in power in Saudi Arabia, and they have the same means of control.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. I want to make
sure. He'd be better at it, but I'll try.
What you're saying is that the dangers that America faces, that they're just as Americans faces, that they're just as declawed politically as the people in Saudi Arabia, so that makes them susceptible.
And they're waking up to it. The average American has as much control over the American government as the average Saudi citizen has over the king. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right. So a lot of this alt-right, what they're pushing is, look at the European migration crisis.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman was like an underground book in Saudi Arabia when I was there.
Yeah.
Like, it was a book people whispered about. Anyway, go ahead.
So, I mean, what they're saying is that if you look at the migrant crisis in Europe and what's happening in countries like Sweden and Germany, they're trying to demonize Islam as a whole. So, like, the radical part of Islam is applied to all of these migrants in their rhetoric. And now, it's not just going to be Europe. It's going to be Canada under, what's his name, Trudeau, and America under Obama and Clinton. And Trump is the only answer to stopping that with his Muslim ban. Or all immigration ban?
All illegal immigrants, because if you get permission, then you're you're no longer having any type of evil...
agenda.
Yeah, agenda or predisposed to evil activities. But one of the things,
because you signed a document,
because you filled out paperwork. Paperwork cures all evils.
Yeah, once you sign those documents, you can go to flight schools and all kinds of wonderful opportunities open up to you.
There's so many big points that people are missing, and just in a couple of things that you mentioned, you talk about the migrant crisis over in Europe, and everybody talks about how rape is just going crazy. Like, people thought that people were dying in the streets because there wasn't nationalized health care here in America.
Here's what I don't get about this whole issue about immigrants being rapists. Okay, there's a rapist in Mexico, and then he moves to the United States. Scenario one. There's a rapist in Mexico. In which scenario are more women raped?
But the thing that they're complaining about
it's the same. It doesn't make any difference. It only matters if you believe that the woman on your side of the fence is more important.
It's about the who's been raped by who, kind of, you know, and the melanin content of the raper, you know?
Yeah, well, I think there's that. Okay, so there's that otherism and there's that tribalism part of it, right? And it's outside. I mean, this has always been the game. Outsiders coming in and they mean to do you harm.
Wait a minute.
That's really rough as an outsider.
That's not totally tribal, though. I mean, like, if someone were doing crimes in my neighborhood versus, like, 5,000 miles away, I'm going to care more because they're closer to me.
Okay, but
it's proximity, not my tribe.
Well, okay, but there's
like,
that.
Like, not in my neighborhood. Hey, man, we don't do that here.
Right.
Leave her alone.
I think there's a nationalist component that's more important here. Like, I totally get what you're saying. But, I mean, we're closer to most of Mexico here than we are to where Daryl lives. You know, and so
Hawaii.
Like, yeah, that's the United States. We're in the United States. So I think
I'm closer to Mexico than I am to here.
Right. Exactly. And they're also making it as an economic argument. You know, so we all know the story with Mexicans. They come here, they get on welfare and
our jobs.
You know,
they get on welfare and take our jobs. but going back to this whole rape thing in Europe, are there actually this many rapes going on that can be attributed to immigrants or refugees or whatever? Or are these things being blown out of proportion?
One argument that kind of goes against what you would say, and I'm not saying it's a powerful argument, but, you know, a Mexican rapist exists and rapes women in Mexico, or a Mexican rapist exists, moves to the United States legally or illegally and rapes people here. What's the difference?
Where is he more likely to get caught?
He's going
to
get shot in the U.S. Mm. I mean, I think it's more likely that he'll face consequences here.
Right, so he could meet his demise here.
He could get away with less rapes here.
And if we had Jeff Berwick here, he would possibly say something else as well, since he lives in Mexico.
What do you
but he might be armed, but I don't think most people are they?
No, I don't think most people are either.
Hmm. Armed is one thing, but responsive and doing something is another.
Mm, yeah, that's true.
And, you know, so in other words, how effective, you know, what's really going on? I don't really know. It's good to, like, I don't know. I see a lot of angst and things like that. I mean, there was like a whole entire podcast, Red Ice Creations. It was once multi-spectrum and open-minded. And then at some point, getting really, really on the, you know, whites need to stick together kind of thing. The perspective majorly changed, you know. And I think that that was just indicative of a perspective, again, a perception management. Somehow or other, the open-mindedness got funneled into... okay, I have a certain conclusion. This is true. That's what I was basically seeing.
Well, I think, again, it's that equal and opposite response thing to diversity, right?
Mandating
diversity. So the host of Red Ice lives in the United States, but his heritage is Swedish, where the migration is definitely a cultural and economic problem in that country where the population is extremely homogeneous. So... an influx of any kind of outsiders is going to be disturbing in multiple ways.
This is the exact same fallacy in reverse as the diversity crowd. Who's to say that it's homogeneous?
The population of New Hampshire is pretty homogeneous.
There could be a huge variety of ideologies. Like, there could be all kinds of diversity in other...
There could be.
You think there isn't even...
I don't think there is. In New Hampshire? I mean, this whole region seems to have its own culture. It has... you know, its own set of ideologies. But, you know, outside of that, it's not crazy. It's mostly all white people.
All right, so what...
certain economic class.
Let's define homogeneous versus heterogeneous in this context. We would have race,
yeah,
religion, ethnic background, political views, economic status. I would say if those were just five criteria, and that covers a lot of ideology, religious and political... New Hampshire would be much more homogeneous than most places. Now, Sweden has a small population. You could pick any one of those countries. You know, that is a kind of ethnicity that gravitated together into that one place. You know, most of the countries in Europe are very homogeneous and have been for a long time, racially, ethnically, religiously.
From each other.
Culturally, and... you know, it's hard to pin politically on that too, but I mean, Great Britain, which is also was a fairly homogeneous place 20 years ago, has more political diversity than any other place that I can think of in Western Europe. So for Sweden, where you have cultural homogeneity, racial homogeneity, ethnic homogeneity, political and religious homogeneity, and even a relatively tight concentration in the middle economically, the arrival of people who are, you know, from a different culture, from a different economic status, from a different religious belief, is clearly disturbing to people like the host of Red Ice Radio. Right or wrong, it's just a fact. It just is.
It's disruptive.
Yeah.
It's oil and vinegar. So, I mean, some people don't mix.
Right.
How do you know it's not lemon and lime?
Some people do mix. I mean, you would be able to tell if they're getting along, you know, if they're doing business with each other, if they're not killing each other. But I think there is a lot of crime happening in between these two groups, isn't there?
Yeah. And these differences, like, I think culturally, religiously... I think the Muslims from the Middle East into Europe is a pretty clear distinction. But we've seen this in New Hampshire with just like white people probably raised in Christian households flooding into a town of white people probably raised in Christian households called Keene, and all chaos breaking loose.
Yeah. No, you guys have a very large Somali population. Did you know that? You have one of the largest Somali populations in the country. They immigrated here from an African Muslim majority country. They open butchers and they, you know, like they, so they didn't go around raping your women as far as I know. Have you guys heard of a rash of Somali men raping women?
Mm-mm.
No.
So what I'm dealing with right now is what's the easiest kind of difference to perpetuate fear with? And I think it's racial, black versus white.
Somali's as dark as it gets, man.
Yep.
If that's your trigger, like... So what is this fear? Are people afraid that their children aren't going to be the same skin tone as them? Is that the fear?
Well, they're...
Like,
well,
It's like the whole Red Scare. They're afraid that countries are going to catch communism.
Well, it depends on who.
Or they're afraid that their race is going to get wiped out by the Browning of America, or Sharia law is going to come here, and Dearborn, Michigan is going to expand and take over. And incidentally, I lived in the Dearborn area for most of my life, and I can't think of a single beheading in my 40-some years of existence. You don't have a bunch of rapes going on down there. And quite frankly, it's a rather peaceful area.
Yeah.
And that's the largest Middle Eastern and Muslim community in the United States, and one of the largest outside of the Middle East.
I lived in a place called Little Kabul, and it wasn't just called that by Muslims, it was called that by everybody. The actual municipal name was Hayward, but it was such an influx of Afghani immigrants that it came to be known that because of the clothing stores, because of the restaurants, because of the everything. And I don't know, I don't think I even remember ever seeing a police officer, so I don't know if there could really be crime. I mean, it was clean. It was, everything seemed to run perfectly smoothly.
Is there, I don't, the fear, I think the Sharia law thing is a big fear of that kind of, like, or are groups like ISIS using migrant movements as a something to infiltrate? This is where the fear comes from.
As an active plot, that is a thing that someone in that position, that is the avenue they would want to take.
Right. So it's not just otherism, or these people look different from me, or these people believe different things from me. It's this idea that I think really sprung from 9/11.
But for some people, it is. Like for some people, if ISIS didn't exist, they would feel the same way about the woman moving from Egypt to Detroit or whatever.
I think so.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think those kind of prejudices existed before, but now they see what is being accomplished, I think, by the alt-right is that they're taking whatever people believe about ISIS or whatever people believe about Sharia law, and they're superimposing it onto everybody who's part of any migration movement anywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And they're saying this is agenda-driven, and the agenda is the demise of the West. Like, this is what's being pushed, you know? So that is very, very troubling because that could have...
The demise of the West is happening all on its own.
What part of this is ringing true for you, Brett? Is it this, like... Something about the way the mainstream politicians or the talkers on TV are pushing this fear about immigration. Is that something that strikes a chord with you, or is that something that you see as like, this is wrong? What part of it is ringing either true or false for you? What's
the compelling element or elements, plural?
All right. Well, there's the question of, does culture actually matter? Do people of such vastly different backgrounds actually mix successfully in large numbers? And I don't know the answer. To even have to think about that, I'm like, holy shit.
I live on an example.
Really?
Big Island.
But I never thought.
Do you ever look at the ethnicity now? Like there is no majority there, literally.
What do you mean?
You look at the ethnicity right now. It's like, you know, it's like 20%, 30%. It's like all these different ethnicities coming from all over the place.
What's that like?
It right now, at this point in 2016, it has reached a level of more harmony. Go back about 10 years, not so much. Violence was considerably up. But there certainly was like that mixing time. At this point, you know, there's been enough, you know, dating, intermarriage, that kind of thing. And there certainly is this type of general philosophy called aloha is there, you know. So there is some element of that. But when you put the pressure on, in other words, whenever the screws are put to people, then there is this like little bit of a tribal thing, you know. Those who pass for Hawaiian, which could be even looking Japanese, basically, kind of all together to that, and as they would call all of us people Haole, which just essentially just means of Caucasian descent. You know, actually, it means people who don't breathe. That's literally what it means, no breath, and. There's a whole story behind that kind of thing. But what I'm saying is, like, it's a weird experiment, like that type of thing, of actually not having a majority race. You know, and like, you know, most of my whole life I lived in places where like there was a majority kind of thing, like super Jewy New York, where I started, you know. And yeah,
that's Trinidad,
that's
was very much like
Jew
that.
Jew bump nose kind of thing. Yeah. And it's a weird thing like that. But I think that there is this type of thing where you're seeing, Brett, maybe it's a compelling thing for both of us. People are being molded by the narrative is being sculpted. Get people over there on each of these sides. And I don't, since I don't have a Daryl Intelligence Agency, I don't really have people to go out and say, here's what the people in the big bad boardrooms are actually sculpting all these people to go ahead and do. But I suspect, I speculate. And in that speculation, I'm trying to like also see and smell which way the smoke is blowing from. And that's kind of what I'm doing. So yeah, you know, that guy, Brett, heard me use these metaphors before. For you, I just wanted to share, you know.
Now, when you talk... When you talk about the ISIS invasion threat, you know, the undercover operatives are sneaking in with the refugees and everything else. That
let me be clear too that this was I'm saying that this these are the talking points of the alt-right, and yeah. This is something that I got kind of called to the carpet in my Facebook group about this because I said that I listened to Gavin McGinnis or I'm interested in. You know, or I said Cantwell. Like, I check in, I listen to his show sometimes. Not because I'm like, man, this guy's hitting home runs. I think there's something about him that I like. I think he's a good guy in there, you know. I believe that, and he's very smart, and it's a tremendous challenge. I don't go, yes, another one out of the park, Chris. Way to go, you know. And I told him when I did his show, I said I listen to you because I don't agree. I'm tired of listening to people I agree with, so I listen to people that I don't agree with. That is the only criteria is that they're intelligent, and he's demonstrated that. Sometimes I've shut his show off before and been like, "Hold, I can't believe the shit that he says or the shit that he thinks." But I honestly I don't listen that regularly, but I'm really interested in having my fingers on the pulse of this movement that's growing not only in momentum and not only in the dark corners of the internet, but now has a representative who is the presumptive Republican nominee for president. You know, and this is – there's a lot of fear in that. So I'm not saying, yeah, you know, I really identify with all these things that the alt-right is afraid of. I'm afraid of how much momentum and acceptance this has gained all the way right up to almost neo-Nazism in its [S2] Yeah. [S1] in its furthest reaches to the right. How much acceptance this has gained in the last year. And I really want to see, okay, what elements of truth exist in this? You know?
Little or none.
And why is there this insistence that culture matters, that race matters, that, you know, like, is there any fire behind all of this smoke, you know, of things like race and IQ and all this stuff? I'm just like, why are people perpetuating these ideas? Why am I being forced to think about, can different people actually live together harmoniously? Why am I thinking about that? Shouldn't I know that the answer is yes? Why am I even, why is part of my mind even debating this? You know, so I find the whole phenomenon fascinating and scary, and I want to understand it. I want to see where it's going, but I find myself, asking questions, and I'm not coming down. I don't feel myself going that way at all, you know. And I think that whole world is very insular. The people in that world are listening to each other, and that's kind of pushing them further into the alt-right. And I think that's dangerous. I think it's very, very important to not just check in with your, you know, ideological opponents, but also to listen to them. And to interact with them, and not a lot of that is happening. And as that insularity becomes stronger, they move further and further and further and seem to gain more momentum. It's a troubling thing on many fronts.
Well, and I'm going to get a little bit long-winded here because there's really a few things I need to cover, but the ISIS undercover operative really provides the perfect uncatchable boogeyman, the problem that keeps popping up that can never be solved, the whack-a-mole.
Oh, in 2006, I remember I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, and he started using this phrase, white Al-Qaeda. And I said, oh, shit, this is the new thing.
No, dude, that's God, what is his name?
The kid they found?
Austin Peterson?
No. The white Al-Qaeda. This is the white Taliban.
This was like right after 9/11.
Right after 9/11. Johnny Walker. He's from my high school graduating class. I'm the other Muslim that converted.
Southern Band 500. That's not bad.
I never met him. We weren't friends or anything. But I followed his case a lot, and it's interesting. He's got a mom just like Lynn who goes around and advocates for his innocence and his genius and his like he's got a whole story. I wish I remembered better than I do.
His name was Jonathan Walker Lind, I think. Right?
There you go.
Yeah. And this was right after 9/11. They found this guy. They were digging him out of the rubble, and they're like, he's white, and he's from the United States. And that should have been – I think I was too terrified at that moment, and I hadn't really woken up to how the fear machine worked yet. But when I heard in 2006, 2007, Rush Limbaugh start talking about white Al-Qaeda, I was like, that's it. It's everybody. It's all of us, you know?
We're sleeper cells.
So I'm just adding
Ross,
that in.
Yeah. Ross Ulbricht is, in a way, the collateral damage of that mentality. Like, the war on drugs was amplified by the war on terror, and he was swept up in the war on drugs fundamentally. Like, the resources and the encroachments and the equipment that they had to run a drug bust on Ross was because of the war on terror.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. So I'm just... you know, seconding what you're saying. Yeah.
It provides a wonderful fear point. Now, I'm not saying that the politicians are evil geniuses and that they're orchestrating this. You know, I think a lot of them actually believe that Al-Qaeda is hiding around every bush.
Well, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is also completely different. This is another reason why the John Walker Lind thing is absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah, but nobody understands that because, you know, Fox News and MSNBC and whatever. But the whole thing is you have a way to control people through fear. You can keep them paying attention to the color changes of the terrorism alerts and all this other stuff. And I was in Germany when the wall came down. I was stationed there back in my old days before I accepted liberty as my Lord and Savior and gave up statism. But I remember talking to one of the old-time sergeants. He was a Vietnam vet. And I says, so what's the deal, Sarge? Are we all unemployed now? Do we have to go get real jobs? You know, there's no more any enemy left. And he says, son, don't you worry. There'll be a new enemy soon enough. And this was something that Jeffrey Tucker talked about today in his speech, that, you know, you have to have an enemy. You have to have something to fight against. And it's very 1984.
Need National Hate Minute.
Yeah.
Right. So is the alt-right using a page out of the playbook of the power structure from like 2001 to 2003, where we gain power by the fears we perpetuate, the fear of the other that we perpetuate, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
How about yes?
But even more, I think they actually believe it, because if you look at the alt-right or just the neoconservatives in general, they're a very militaristic mindset. They believe that there's not a problem that can't be solved by invading it.
Right.
They're very authoritarian leaning. You know, they claim that they hate the government, but they love the police and military, which actually inflict government policy upon them. So with that mindset of, okay, the military's got to do this and everything's about security, whereas, you know, the lefties are more the social things, the welfare, the education, the healthcare. The right is the security mindset. So they see everything as a security issue. The best metaphor for it is when your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Daryl, have you ever heard of terror management theory?
No, that's a new one. Can you give me a little backstory?
There's a whole – if somebody who has the internet could pull it up, and we could just look into it a little bit. Terror management theory is basically the name that's been given to this phenomenon of this kind of otherism, tribalism, and the fears of outsiders that it produces, and some of the qualities that actually or the behaviors that grow out of that. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
In social psychology, terror management theory, TMT, proposes a basic psychological conflict that results from having a desire to live, but realizing that death is inevitable. The conflict produces terror and is believed to be unique to human beings.
The point is that, like, a set of behaviors comes with this. Seriously. Like the drive to have children, the drive to procreate, the need to get married, concern about the future, like things that people weren't thinking about on the regular. They have this sense of mortality, and we see where some of the sources of that sense of mortality are coming from through the current events. It's immediately like you listen to McGinnis. He's like, "You're 32," and you look. Somebody calls in. He basically has this inquisition with them, like he's the Nazi minister of eugenics. "You're 32. Are you married? How many kids do you have? You're 32 and you're not married. Aren't you ever going to have kids? How many kids do you think you can have by the time you're 40 if you're not even married and you're 32?
Right.
You know? I mean, like, these are the kinds of conversations that's happening. And he is totally off the deep end with the, you know, what does Molyneux call it? The
R versus K?
No, he doesn't go there. I mean, I think he totally – he's a real race and IQ guy, but also the shit. Yeah,
I'm glad you brought up Molyneux.
Does culture matter is one of the things that you asked. And it's been rolling around my head since. I think, yeah. And that connects to the terror management theory because it's not a person's will to live that is causing all of these, you know, people like Trump to be popular. It's their ego. It's their identity. You know, the culture that they have is what's dying, not themselves, not their lives, you know.
But it's not. It's not dying. It's just being relegated to the status of every other culture on the continent.
Well, I think that's their fear, though. It's like because they're so wrapped up in their culture, that becomes their identity. And any change to that culture is a death to them, death to their own personal ego.
Their argument would be, Western civilization is the gift to human existence. All the great developments come from Western civilization. This is what they say. You're welcome. Sincerely, the white people, the Christians, Western Europeans. So if they can convince themselves that that's being stamped out, it is essentially the end of civilization. So that's how
but
we.
That's not true. It's not remotely true,
right? If you have the big picture perspective, but this is everybody is like so many of the people that we used to respect, or who I would potentially respect, are jumping into this ship, right? And this is why Steph lost a lot of support because he went full throttle with the whole Freedom Club thing, and it's like what the Freedom Club? Does that include Germans? You know, it's like it was hard. It was a hard concept to wrap my mind around at first. And, you know, when it comes to does race matter, does culture matter, can these types of people live together? I think the answer is obviously yes. But one of the things that really strains those relationships is when they're competing for resources at the behest of the government. Right.
It doesn't get to matter when it doesn't get to matter to immigration policy. Like, it gets to matter to people you let on your own property.
Right.
But, like, the fact – it doesn't matter. Like you don't – yeah, it matters whether you get a pinata at a party or a balloon machine. Like, culture matters. The dish you want that makes you feel better when you're sick matters. They're like, I don't know, deep neurologically speaking, maybe there's different endorphins that trigger when you're surrounded by people with your same melanin. That's a possible theory. It doesn't matter to immigration policy. It doesn't matter to who is allowed to step on what soil. Like, I don't get it. I don't get the whole connection to the issue.
Is there a way to summarize this pain point, this obstacle that we're describing right now? Like, I wanted to like make it concise, so I can just go out like sunrise and just solve this one. You know. Do you understand my question?
Are you asking for my pain point or their pain point?
We're all describing. We've been talking about the same thing for, I don't know, at least the past hour. I'm trying to like summarize it in some concise, I don't know, four sentences, two sentences, whatever it takes. Like,
what is
the obstacle? What does it consist of?
Pain point is the term you're using?
Pain point, obstacle. Like, in other words, we see perception management has created this perception, this divide and conquer thing going on. There are a lot of people who perceive that they are in a group that is in danger from this other group right now. And the other group looks like this and does these things. Their group looks like this and does these things. And hopefully, you know, these things, you didn't have children yet with someone who looks like you? oh no, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, that's a part of it too, yeah.
Yeah, or...
So it is, it's fear that your children will be brown. Your grandchildren will be brown?
I'm not saying that's a big part of it, and I think what Daryl is asking for is, like, what's the central pressing problem that we would be trying to solve here?
I am trying to get it concise, it's true.
Yeah.
It's a familiarity bias, and I mean that in any sense of familiarity, and I mean that literally as a logical fallacy of bias. You're not safer with the familiar.
What if it's a diversion? What if blaming people of different races is the government's way or the pundit's way of shifting the focus away from their own failures?
But it's there for everybody to exploit, right? Like, it doesn't need to be a grand government or what's, you know, manipulating governments in the shadows kind of conspiracy. Talk show hosts can use it. Trump can use it. The left has their own version of all of this. As long as it increases the fear, people can benefit from it. So, yeah, could it be an organized... Because I remember, like, watching TV, there are YouTube channels like Alex Jones 2.5 years ago. I was like, are they trying to start a race war? They want us to have a race war? Is that where this is going?
Race war? Pretty
much. Why do they want that? This is new. I haven't heard about a race war, but I think they're trying to start one. I remember like having this conversation with myself.
You know what my problem is with race wars? The presumption that you're on a side. Like,
okay, well, how much thinking gets shut down by being identified as white, you know?
And oh, quite a bit.
Or
exactly.
Liberty-loving.
So it's an easy way to shut down. Race war is a very effective way to shut down a lot of critical thought. And I think that's one of the reasons why it would be useful.
Hmm. Who's pushing it?
Well, the media loves it. You guys ever heard of a show called Red Bar Radio?
Yeah.
All right. So, Mike, I know I told this story somewhere. Mike, who's the host of Red Bar Radio,
yeah,
used to do these after shows, kind of like in this format that we're in right now, you know? But he would, him and his co-host would drink excessively. So one year he had, it was around Christmas time, and he had this guy from the Netherlands in his house, and they had been many hours into an after show. They were very, very drunk, and they were doing karaoke. So Mike proceeded to do the theme song from the television cartoon DuckTales. But every time the word duck was used, he said nigger instead. And kind of rewrote some racist lyrics around that. And this was the kind
of... So I have a question about this.
But this is something that should have been, you know, the next day when you hear it, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I was that drunk. How embarrassing. I should delete this. But he put it in his bonus content section. Was never released as a podcast. Somebody took it out of the bonus content section and started posting it on YouTube. Right? Just different versions of the song. So... Cut to years later.
Would that be a violation of his terms of service?
No, he didn't like that this happened because what happened was really bad. It kind of got
into the hands... But it wasn't explicitly prohibited?
It got into the hands of the 4chan people, and they said,
oh, no.
How can we use this DuckTales theme song with the N-word replacing the word duck? What can we do with this? So what 4chan started doing, and this is I'm kind of spoiling the climax of the story, but I have to tell the story this way. They started posting videos to YouTube of, like, here's the coolest new Jay-Z song, right? So it'd be, like, Jay-Z and then the title of his newest hit, but they would put the audio from this song in its place. So you would have these videos that would be the DuckTales Red Bar song, but it would have, like, a million listens, or at least a million starts to listen. So cut to 2015, mid-2015, this story comes out about this horrible hate crime perpetuated in one of America's high schools, where a student, a white student in an all-white school, or an all-white school terrorizes a majority black visiting football team with a racist song. They played the Red Bar N-word DuckTales theme song on the PA system while the visiting team was warming up.
My school did this?
What?
My school did this. It wasn't this song, but it's this concept. So in Marin, they keep all the black people in Marin City. Marin County is mostly white, and they bust the brown people in to clean their toilets and sweep their whatever, and it's a fight over transportation. It's whatever. It's hippies versus labor class, okay?
Right.
When Drake High School, the predominantly African-American high school, played at Redwood High School, a predominantly Caucasian high school. They made racial taunts. Mm-hmm. They chanted nigger at the black team.
Oh my God.
The audience did. like this is something that happens.
I've never heard of that, because this story that I'm telling, it's completely made up.
Oh.
I'm shocked.
Wait, this DuckTales thing didn't happen?
No, the DuckTales theme song is real. We can pull it up on YouTube and we can hear it, but I don't think anyone should ever have to hear it, because it's not even funny. Like, I think there is such a thing as racial humor. That's fine. Sometimes it works great. This is just the terrible ranting of a drunk maniac. And I think he doesn't like that this song is out there. Like, he definitely goes that way with humor, but even he is, I think, kind of astonished that this came out of his mouth one night. So the story is presented in the media: black visiting football team harassed by this hate crime as racist music played over the PA system. The real story was, the home team makes a warm-up tape where somebody goes and downloads songs from YouTube based on the title, puts it on a flash drive, and then plays it over the PA system. Probably without listening to the songs.
Because it's in the title.
So one of the kids goes to get a, I don't know, Pharrell song or whatever, doesn't listen to it, downloads it, puts it on the drive, and unfortunately, it's the Red Bar DuckTales song for everybody at the football game. So could have been like, wow, what a shitty, unfortunate mistake that was. Damn it, 4chan, you got us again. And I mean, they were doing shit like, not just like at a football game, 4chan people were like playing this, they were like pushing it into classrooms in high schools, like playing it through the PA system, just into a classroom. So, I mean, that's 4chan. But the media picks up the story, and it has to be this racially motivated hate crime. That's the only explanation. So then Mike hears about it. He talks about it on the show. He investigates it himself. He figures out what happens. Nobody fucking cares what the real story is and how simple it actually is. No, it is racism, and it is, you know, so symbolic of the larger problem in America that is now bleeding down into the high schools. And yeah, okay, racism is a thing, but can you at least report like the real stories and not make them up and not hide the truth to divide people apart? So I'd say the media at all levels, and I'm not just talking about in the, you know, the behind the closed doors of the editorial room at Fox News or MSNBC, but this is like local media saying, no, sorry, race story plays better than guy puts wrong song on CD because 4chan. We'll take the racial angle. There were black kids on the visiting team. There were white kids on the home team. The home team was actually majority white.
Did you see Nightcrawler?
Yeah.
It's great. It's probably one of my favorite movies in recent history.
Did that have a...
definitely had a what bleeds leads news angle to it. Like he's collecting footage for news, right? And it's local news. And yeah, I mean, like obviously the main character is a sociopath, and it's about his descent into whatever he's considering art. But like it definitely has, like the infrastructure around him exists and rewards his behavior because what bleeds leads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now blood is replaced by racial strife. The Nightcrawler example, you see the problem in that movie, right? Because he's going out looking for blood.
Yeah.
So when you replace if it bleeds, it leads with if it's about racial differences or racial problems, it leads.
Mm-hmm.
What do you get? Exactly what we're getting. People trying to find racism everywhere and exploit it and not care about what the truth is. And I think one of the reasons why the alt-right is gaining acceptance is because the left's, especially in higher education, their war on reality and free speech has gotten so out of control that most people don't know how to approach that problem constructively. So, popcorn kernel, excuse me, equal and opposite reaction.
Wait, are you sure most people don't know how?
Most people, I'm not saying most people can't, but I am saying most people don't know how, or they don't have the motivation to approach it constructively.
Okay, that's a claim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with the if it bleeds, it leads, if a reporter or reporters, a network, whatever, is going out and they're looking for blood and they can't find blood, and there's nothing that says that they can't create blood, because, as you said, that's the type of a story that keeps, you know, stays at the top of the headlines. Well,
this is like that's false kind of flag the, hate crimes. Yeah. Like, it's been, I mean, every group that's been able to traffic power from aggrievement has committed hate crimes against themselves. Like, I mean, I'm sure they're isolated incidents. I hate to assume of them. But graffiti of various kinds has been found to be like I don't know. I can't think of an example off the top of my head.
No, you're absolutely right. And what,
swastikas on a synagogue might have been done by a Jew, for example.
Exactly.
I've heard that story. I've definitely heard of Muslims doing this, or at least being accused of it.
It's getting real popular in college. Girls are sending themselves emails from other accounts saying that some Trump supporter said he was going to rape me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
it's like framing someone that doesn't exist. You can frame a digital person to prove a crime occurred.
Yeah. False. Yeah. So that's happening. And there was, I'm forgetting the details, but there was one really big story that blew up in somebody's face like this. But Lou is saying, why wouldn't they just go out and create blood? Well, that's kind of the warning in Nightcrawler, right? Like, he does wind up going and doing something.
He is complacent in allowing a person to die. He doesn't kill anyone.
Right. So he could have stopped his crime, but because he needs the blood, he lets the blood flow.
Yeah.
Right? So we're seeing the same problem in this other arena with race. And that is... So, Daryl, when you said I made a claim, I'm happy to hear your refutation of it, but people are being set up to fail in that respect by consuming this media, you know? And by just being further exposed to this environment that media creates, it's driving people in opposite directions. So I think even there's a part of me. So here's the interesting challenge. There's a part of me that finds this is as much as I might have been willing to admit on my show before.
Visual humor on the radio.
There's Daryl and I are poised to throw popcorn at each other, but I think we're both going to eat it instead. There's a part of me that finds this allure or this gravity in it's almost like unconscious towards the simple answer that the alt-right wants to provide. Now, I don't go there. And when I did this show on college race tensions, there was a big swath of it that I cut out where I played these two black Ivy League college professors talking about Black Lives Matter. And I used the clip in the show, but I had it like a monologue after where I said, you know, when I first encountered a piece of audio or a piece of video that said, here's two black college Ivy League college professors, one from Brown, one from NYU, talking about Black Lives Matter, something snapped in my mind. And Nick, snap for me. Give me a snap. Something snapped in my mind. I hurt my thumb and can't snap. Where I said, oh, I know exactly what their point of view is going to be. You know? And I asked people in the audience, like, can you admit to yourself that maybe you did that a little bit too? That when you heard two black Ivy League college professors, some kind of preconceived idea about, like, some kind of efficient or shortcut kind of thinking formed in your head to say, it's like something that's, you know, you see a girl who looks like that girl in the hippie meme, you know, like, ask for more government, and then gets more government with the police beating people. We've all seen that hippie girl in the meme. You see somebody in real life like that.
At Porkfest.
At Porkfest, and you go, oh, one of these. Now, maybe you don't, and good on you for not doing it, but part of me does. And I want to kind of bring that part to the forefront, and maybe not publicly, maybe I'll never mention it again, but why is that? Is it just some kind of innate tribalism that I have? When I see the other, I say, I get what you're all about, or I know what you're going to do, or you're one of those. I don't act on it. It's not something I say out loud. It doesn't foster any hatred in me of those people, but it is a prejudice that exists. And I used that clip originally, even though I kind of hid this part about why, to say, does this prejudice, does this shorthand thinking or this shortcut thinking exist to some extent in your mind as well? You know?
Yeah, let me give you a potential answer to that question on whether or why people use these simplistic judgments. and do it so quickly, right? And to me, it's, I think it makes sense that it could be useful. Like, what do you lose by making that simple judgment of that hippie, right? Like, what are you going to get out of it if you recognize that maybe this isn't a liberal? Maybe this is not somebody that supports gun control. You're never really going to see that person ever again. And it can be safe to assume that you shouldn't trust that person, right? That's going to provide you more safety. But like you're bringing up, right? That's not rational. That doesn't contribute to critical thinking or a open mind, right? I think, but not many people are looking for that. So I think that, and I don't think people in history have been doing that, right? So I think that it's easy to go into that, and I think that might be the reason, just because you don't really lose anything by doing it, except critical thinking and open-mindedness.
Well, yeah, sure. One thing that's a major issue is people jump to conclusions, they start forming opinions right away, and they do it according to their own confirmation bias. And let me give you an example. There was a cop in Illinois that died. It was either Fox Hills or Fox Lake, Fox River, Fox something or other. So the Blue Lives Matter said, oh, my God, this is horrible, because the cop died of, like, a gunshot wound or something like that. And the Blue Lives Matter said, this is the war on police, and damn it, these people need to learn to respect law and order and all this other stuff. So as soon as the word came out, you know, the blue lines on the black band or whatever came out, and everybody's doing their, you know, we love the cops thing.
Right.
Then on the other side, you have the anti-cop people that are saying, well, fuck him. Glad he got killed. He deserved it and all this other stuff. And, you know, that's just them jumping to the conclusions. What really happened was, it turns out the guy was under FBI investigation, so he killed himself. He committed suicide and tried to set it up to look like a murder.
Oh, yeah.
So it turns out that everybody was wrong, but rather than saying, you know, hey, let's see what the circumstances are here, you know, and yeah, I know that you can't always trust what the police are going to say in the investigation or what the news media is going to say, but rather than jumping to a conclusion and just going balls out on that conclusion right then and there, you know, actually do some examination, actually do some thought and question the information that's given to you. And when you look at all the different things that we've been talking about tonight, there's so many questions that you can ask. You know, when you hear about the immigration crisis in Europe, okay, what is actually happening? Can you verify that it's happening? Can you verify that you have 700 billion rapes in Europe each day? You know, like people are claiming. Is it possible that it's happening? Is it verifiable?
Well, that's like when the Fox News ran with their map of no-go Sharia law zones throughout Europe, and then later it was revealed that what they were actually looking at was a map that the city was using for areas that needed development. So, like, all of the orange areas were, like, it was the municipal code for, like, pave the roads in that county, you know? Like...
Well, that should get the Fox News crowd opposed to the roads then. They'll be joining us.
I'm sure they issued a retraction at some point, 2 a.m., whatever. They said it out loud after it was on all their talk shows and opinion. When people still say it on AM radio that it's true, they still think that these things exist.
So I guess the point that I'm coming to is, I don't believe in grand conspiracies because that requires grand conspirators. And I'm a big fan of Hanlon's razor, as Bill Buford calls it. It's never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. And when I see people jumping to conclusions, when I hear the pundits going off and running off of the yap, especially if it's something that I actually know something about and they're giving just blatantly bad information, when I start hearing this, it's like, oh my God, you know, they're idiots. They have no idea what they're doing. This can't be a grand conspiracy. They're too dumb.
Can we let's unpack that a little bit? Never attribute to malice what you can attribute to stupidity. Is that what? So where is there? Let's say where is there stupidity?
Yeah, show me that.
Simplistic judgments, I think, would be an example where, I'm using stupidity as a synonym of ignorance. Mm-hmm.
Done by whom?
the person making the simplistic judgment of the hippie.
But we're talking about in government, right? Yeah. Like that's that example.
Government and media. All right, I'll give you two quick examples. In media, Chris Matthews from Hardball, before he became a pundit, writer, and he was on Tip O'Neill's staff, speechwriter. He was a Capitol Hill police officer, so he was a copper. And that was back in the 70s, back when they carried revolvers. So they're talking about firearms, and here you have a former Capitol Hill cop who's saying, yeah, these police out there, they just have their service revolvers or their service weapons, but these criminals out there, they've got Glocks. Now, keep in mind that the Glock is the preferred issue weapon of most local or most law enforcement agencies, period. But he's acting like the Glock is something more than a pistol. And I'm sure you guys have seen the little joke poster, the meme of firearms identification for journalists. And it shows like a Chevy Nova and it says it's an AR-15. It shows an AR-15, calls it an AK-47. It shows a Glock, it calls it an AR-15. And you know, and then all the different pistols are called Glocks. It's got a squirt gun. It's got one with the little flag that says bang on it. And it's because they have no idea what they're talking about. Now, as far as government goes, back when the whole healthcare debate was going on, back when Obama first went into office, they were talking about Medicare programs. Now, I used to be a licensed insurance agent, and I sold the Medicare supplement programs, the Medicare Advantage, and the Medicare Part D. And the way that politicians were explaining how the Medicare Advantage program worked, it was incorrect. Because they said that it worked just like a Medigap does. Now, being wrong, generally not such a big thing. Now, had I said that, had I made the same claim that politician made in a sales presentation, I could have lost my license because what he said was expressly prohibited by me. I could have been fined. I could have even possibly had jail time had I uttered the same words that this idiot went on national, dare I even say, worldwide TV and said.
All right, so can we introduce the concept of useful idiots? There could be malice above stupidity directing it.
I won't exclude that, but in these particular cases, these people are idiots.
Mm-hmm.
So they're ignorant or they're willfully ignorant, whatever it is. But you know, I don't know if I could really call that a grand conspiracy. Maybe there's somebody up above them saying, you know, hey, go out there and say this. Maybe the researcher gave them bad information.
Well, it'd be hard to say that they're part of a conspiracy if their paycheck simply depends on them continuing to believe the same thing, as is so often the case with people who are trotted out on CNN and MSNBC to talk about guns, or people on Fox who are trotted out to talk about terrorism or Osama bin Laden or Islam. You know, I mean, their paycheck is dependent on the fact that no matter what facts come their way, by the time they show up on television for their next scheduled event, they believe the same thing that they believed last time, and they're pushing the same narrative pushing last time.
Yeah, and it does have to be spun, but I think in a lot of cases, these people actually genuinely believe it. Yeah, when you hear these former military officers, colonels and generals that are consultants to the media networks, you know, their job is to go on there and talk about, you know, how the military should do this, that, and the other thing. And because they come from a military mindset, and chances are they've probably done this, they're going to speak to what they know.
Right.
And it could be a horribly wrong policy, but they believe it. That's how they've done it before. So, I mean, I'm not going to exclude that there could be some malice in that, you know, they are speaking to get their paycheck. But, I mean, for the most part, I think it's a lot of ignorance.
It's all speculation. Wow. We don't have our own intelligence agency. That's what I would be putting forward right now. So I'll sit right there. I think that what the conditioning that I see going on in general, and maybe I might put forward, is what if we're not above this little conditioning, is that conditioning to say you want the certain answer. It's either A or B. It's either stupidity or it's fully, you know, orchestrated malice on from above. What if you don't have to make a choice, but like, you know, here, like going around the spheres like that. Like I just saw my first Black Lives Matter sign today, a yard sign. in Vermont. Mm-hmm. You know, never saw such a thing, you know, before. And I'm thinking, wow, man, like, this is
really, it's real.
This is real. Holy shit, this is real. Like, someone actually went and bought the, and like, and I know, as far as this neighborhood, this super, super white part of Vermont, you know, right where my daughter's mom.
You're implying there's another type of Vermont.
yeah, exactly.
So what I'm saying is, have I missed something? Is Black Lives Matter more than the literal meme that it is? Is it got like an attached movement and ideology now?
A website and a yard sign? Where you could actually buy a Black Lives Matter yard sign? And what
Occupy
I'm saying is,
had those things, but Occupy was distinctly anti-ideological at first.
I attribute that essentially to like really limited thinking and certainly stupidity and not malice. In other words, like a limited hangout. You know, like there would be those, like, I don't know, Jason King making Unsung as you know, like trying to make the Unsung app go forward, you know, as something that seems like likely to be productive in terms of, you know, seeing a problem, solving a problem, like that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And certainly the work you do, Davi. And then, like, I see something like that as, you know, like, I'm helping, you know, like that kind of thing. I see it fully in that direction. Like, I'm going to draw attention, like, I'm going to jump on a bandwagon. It fully is the fallacy.
Well, let's go back to something that you had asked about, and I'm going to address 2 points on there. When we see, like, the reporters or the politicians getting on their bandwagon doing their thing, what do you think happens when Joe Sixpack is watching the evening news and hears a little sound bite of news? You know, and do you think that he rationally thinks it out, or do you think he just, you know, goes with this confirmation bias and everything else? And the other part is, if you are aware that you do that, if you are aware of, I don't know, maybe good thinking skills of, okay, before I freak out, let me ask a few little basic questions. Is it possible? Is this even possible in the first place? Did it happen this way? Can we verify it? How did it happen? You know, stuff like that. And actually gathering some information before you form an opinion. Do you see that as something that you can control and retrain yourself if you're somebody that flies off the handle? Did I make sense?
It does make sense, but I'm seeing the dawn. So that's why I just opened my mouth.
Oh, don't worry. This is New Hampshire. It gets light out at real early.
Yeah. Okay. Big Island, it takes to, you know, 6 a.m., period. People are going to go with their conditioning.
How difficult do you think it is for people to unlearn
the
bad habit?
It's easy as hell, like, as long as you actually have a methodology. It's like, how difficult is it to learn martial arts? It's easy if you actually learn martial arts. How difficult is it to learn how to fix your car? It's easy if you actually have a methodology that actually gives you the fixing your car. How easy is it to have critical thinking? It's easy if you have an actual method for critical thinking.
I stumbled into it entirely by mistake.
I stumbled into it too. I found that dude over there, you know.
Let the record show that Daryl points to Brett Minot.
Yes. Right. So I was in art school with no real interest in critical thinking whatsoever, except, you know, that I liked sci-fi. And Intro to Aesthetics I thought would be an art class, but turns out it's a philosophy class. I became intro to philosophy. I started taking an interest in that direction.
Yeah, I was all through government school without any interest in critical thinking. And I actually stumbled across it in community college, both with I had to take an intro to philosophy class, which was okay, but learning about the scientific method and the ultimate answer in a behavioral biology class really helped me out. And that's probably the most important class I took out of all my years in school.
Well, here's a question like that I would put out there, and I ask this like, you know, when I'm trying to connect with people on a little bit slightly deeper level. I'd be like, so you've been around for a bit. Can you like name for me, say like on a certain topic years ago, you had a certain conclusion. You opened your mind. You took in new evidence. You spoke with other people, and you found out that actually your conclusions shifted. Name some of those. What are the topics? Can you walk me through the process by which you came to move your conclusions?
Who said I concluded? Conclusions cause convicts.
How about this? More like the, like, okay, speculations were more, if you were a betting man, Davi, you would
I'm
be betting this.
I'm not a betting man, except every perception ever.
If you're going to make an action choice, Davi, you're going to choose this way, and then new evidence came in, oh, now I'm going to be
But
moving.
That doesn't make it a conclusion.
I have two answers for that. One, I'm going to agree with Davi and say, no, I drew no conclusions. I repeated. Or I could kind of answer your question a little bit more directly. It'd be easier to list the things that I still agree with from 10 years ago as I do today.
Or it took action in full knowledge of the speculation that it was just to see what would happen.
Fine. I mean, for the most part, I do talk with people and they have a strong desire for certainty.
Yeah.
Like, I am certain about vaccination like this way. I am certain about global warming this way. I am certain about Trump this way. That type of thing. Because I want the right answer. It's a conditioning thing, like the school thing like that. Like, raise their hand, got the answer that the teacher said. I did have an addiction to being certain on things. And yeah, I did definitely come upon the idea of, like, I'm going to change that. I'm going to be a bit way more flexible and more so over time. But when it comes to taking action, at the moment where I'm actually going to take action, that's a decision point. Like, in other words, it's kind of like a de facto kind of conclusion. Like, this is my best thing right now so far, and then I'm going to do something on it. But there are things that are completely academic. There's nothing actionable I'm going to do about it. Mm-hmm. Or, like, you know, I've already done the actionable thing about it. Say, regarding, you know, my child, vaccines, etc. You know, it's no longer actionable. It's now all in her court. She's 20, you know. So I made my choice up until then, but then it's done. You know, so it's a bit like that, you know, like I go in a direction and I love to ask that question.
We're at the 4-hour mark. Oh. So I was thinking about too, just taking a stretch so I can save this recording.
Got it. So you just can't keep. You can't keep running away.
Say your life's too neat to keep. You can't keep running away.